are listening to Conversations with Nathan Latka, where I sit down and interview the top SaaS founders, like Eric Yuan from Zoom. If you'd like to subscribe, go to getlatka.com. We've published thousands of these interviews, and if you want to sort through them quickly by revenue or churn, CAC, valuation, or other metrics, the easiest way to do that is to go to getlatka.com and use our filtering tool. It's like a big Excel sheet for all of these podcast interviews. Check it out right now at getlatka.com.
What was it like ringing that bell in the middle of COVID?
Our CEO, he was extremely upset. This whole chart is kind of my pride and joy.
Eugene, thanks for being here, man. All right. I'm not lying, right? You'll share more data since we've got a more curated audience.
Oh, yeah, we're public, so if I share something I'm not supposed to share, you cannot trade our stock.
Fair enough. So I want to first start and just jump right into the revenue graph, right? So you guys see the company really got going. What was actually first year? Was it 2013?
When I've met founders, 14.
2014 is when you met the founders.
Yeah.
And what was the size of the angel check you put into the company?
So actually, they didn't take my money. They just offered me a job.
Okay.
I pursued them for 2 years, but they were so profitable, the margin was like 40%. They didn't know what to do with money. So I said, why don't we do it this way? I figure out how to speed up business and use more capital, and you give me shares.
Okay, got it. So can you tell me what they ended up comping you? What percent of the company did you own back then?
I mean, it's all public, so in total, I own, at the peak, I owned about 2%.
2% of the company.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So you get going, the company is scaling, you see here, and I got that right? Over $300 million of revenue today?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So
not revenue, ARR.
ARR. Over the next 20 minutes, I studied the public calls. We talked, obviously, before. We want to go deep on a couple sections. Pricing, growth, and then the IPO. So starting on pricing, this was the original pricing page. It was before your time slightly, I think,
yeah.
Right? Well, let me go back. I want you guys to zoom in if you can read it. Can you guys read the price in the little yellow box? Is that big enough? It's $49.95 a month. That's what these guys launched with. And maybe, can you describe the makeup of the two co-founders? Are they tech or business?
They're all tech, engineers by trade. When they first launched SEMrush, actually they used it for other businesses in traffic arbitrage space. So they needed a research tool to figure out where to buy traffic and whom to sell it to. And data was just so good that a lot of people started approaching them and asking an access to this, and that's how they've launched SEMrush. But they didn't really know how to properly monetize, so I think they were giving away just too much of a value.
You guys can't read this. I'm going to read it too. You'll see SEMrush was designed by the developers of SEO Digger and SEO Quake for Google Organic. So they had sort of these micro tools, and to make them win, they built the side project. The side project ends up winning. It's why we talk so much today about go build a side project in the Zoom marketplace, in the Stripe marketplace, in the HubSpot marketplace, because you just don't know where it's going to lead. These guys ended up sitting on, obviously, what we now know now as a gold mine. Back then, 20 million domains, and you can see 85,000 users. One of the early go-to-market motions was this affiliate playbook. So I'll let you guys squint in and read what the original affiliate motion was. Do you guys have an affiliate program today? Did this work?
Still have. It's not as big as it used to be, but I think early on that was extremely important. The way affiliate marketing in B2B SaaS works is not that people will sell your product for you, but if they want to write some kind of article, having an affiliate program gives them extra incentive to write about you.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it really helped to spread the message. It would never work if product was not good, but because product was so good, affiliate network was a huge boost early on. Now it's, of course, a smaller part of the business.
So at its peak, how much revenue did affiliates bring the business?
Oh, at its peak, probably a third.
A third of, and what year was the peak, do you remember? Like
that was around 2012, 2013.
All right, so 2012, 13, and what was revenue back then? That green bar's too small.
I mean, so.
A couple million?
It was a couple of million, three, four million.
Okay, so affiliates take off now. Do you still pay today at scale 40% of monthly recurring revenue back out to affiliates?
We had to, so that's actually something that I don't recommend to do, so do perpetual 40%. We did it because maybe early on we're a little bit desperate. It was a phenomenal deal for affiliates. It attracted a lot of really great people, but perpetual fees, they sort of incentivize people to kind of grab something and do nothing with it, because they just get paid forever. Mm-hmm. So we had to change this perpetual fee, and now we reward people for bringing new customers, but we don't pay perpetual revenue share.
So what do they get now?
Right now, there's just CPA, so you get paid for registration, for trial, and for new paid customer, and there are different tiers, and also depends on country. So, you know, new paying customer in the United States more expensive than in, let's say, Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not mistaken, it's a couple, like, for the whole thing, you'll get a couple hundred dollars.
Greg had hosted a great dinner last night, a Practical Founder Dinner, and we're always looking for unique ways to bootstrap early on. This was, would you say, a key way you got early revenue without outside funding?
Absolutely. 100% recommend, just don't do perpetual fee. Do maybe 2 years, 3 years, not perpetual.
There you go. Have an end date there. You then did raise outside funding. Right, Boston. Yep. Boston Business Journal covered this here. Talk to me about what it was like the day you signed this $40 million term sheet.
So that was the second round. We did a little bit of a smaller deal before that, but the second deal with Graycroft was $40 million. Was also partially secondary. So
how much was secondary?
I don't recall, but it's all in public filings.
Did you take money out on that secondary?
No, not me. No.
Did you fire anyone that took money out? You said, "Oh, you don't believe in the vision."
No,
yeah, that wouldn't be good.
We didn't have to do that.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so you get this done. How much of the company did you sell in this round? Do you remember?
The valuation was around 200 mil.
200. Okay, great. Got it. So 20-25% of the company is what you're selling there. Now, moving forward, I want to talk about this because everyone knows this graph, right? And it's all about, for each cohort of customers you sign up, how does revenue expand or contract? What does net dollar retention look like over time? The dark red bar you see here is basically the cohort of customers you guys signed up before 2016. And what we see, especially like with the blue bar, is you're signing up more customers faster, but you're also getting them to pay more faster. How is that happening?
So, this whole chart is kind of my pride and joy, because when I joined, it didn't necessarily look this way. So we had to work a lot on monetization. Early on, we would sort of get a customer through the door very quickly, recover a customer acquisition cost very fast, generate a lot of cash. But we didn't focus that much on expansion. Mm-hmm. So when I joined, we changed monetization entirely to drive more expansion down the line. And at the peak, we got over 120% net revenue retention, which is like for SMB, MarTech business is just phenomenal. Mm-hmm.
What's the guidance you've given this year in terms of where you guys think you'll come out in terms of NRR?
We don't guide NRR. The last quarter was 107.
Okay, 107. Got it. Interesting. So we'll come back to this chart in a second with some more recent cohorts, but I want to go back to what you guys were selling in 2020. This was the headline. Do you remember this headline? You've moved away from this since then.
A little bit, because I think when you say you do all-in-one, people don't understand what you're really doing. So. You want to be a little bit more specific about the portfolio of products, and also sometimes at the top of the landing page you want to be more of a call to action. Mm-hmm. But if you look at what we're selling, it's actually in the middle. So different toolkits, SEO, social media, content marketing, competitive intelligence. So still very successfully sell all those products and adding more and more and more. And now adding tons of AI features and so on.
And we'll jump more into the AI, but having a product suite, obviously, of five product features is great. Getting customers to actually use all five product features is a different story, and a key way to get people to use all five features is to make sure you structure your pricing. So this new and updated pricing page looks a lot different from $49.95 back in 2010. How did you go from $49.95 to this?
Really, first time we did big pricing changes, we just did it through experimentation. So we tried new price, we checked if there is a difference in conversion rate, how this difference in conversion rate compares to the gain in average revenue per customer, how we retain customers down the line. Experience was extremely successful, we just rolled it out. Mm-hmm. The second time, board challenged us a little bit more to do it in a more scientific way. So we worked with guys at a company called ProfitWell. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of customer surveys, and not just surveying SEMrush customers, existing customers, but people who are in the market for products like this. and got a lot of price sensitivity and packaging studies, and then we made a decision around this price.
Can you guys, if you look really closely at the descriptions under each price point, do you see anything sort of interesting or very non-standard? If you look at the descriptions under each pricing plan, most pages like this, you'll see numbers. It'll say, number of contacts, one, and then 50, and then there's real utility-based upselling. I imagine it was an intentional choice that you avoided that in this screenshot. Why?
Right. Our value metrics, let's put it this way. For someone who is just buying this first time, they're not obvious. They make sense once you use the product. Early on, if I tell you you can have X keywords or X projects, it doesn't really tell you much. And then also, we had value metrics like number of reports per page, which is, again, if you haven't seen the product, you don't know what is the value of report per page. So we focused on functionality, actual problems that you can solve with the product rather than, value metrics, because product is, I think, more complex than your average product.
Mm-hmm. You talk about startups and freelancers in that first plan. It talks way more to from an emotional perspective to the folks that should be buying each sort of price point, but it still worked because we see your average revenue per user, especially on obviously the ACV basis, growing year after year. Talk to me about what the team looks like that's in charge of driving this kind of expansion in first year ACV.
So on the strategic level, it's really me and our COO, and we do a lot of kind of high-level planning. So we design really kind of three axes expansion model. So axis number one is we want people to move between core plans, and this is primarily usage-based. And then second axis is number of users that we buy. So we think about viral hooks, how to sort of convince people to invite their colleagues to work together, because we have so much functionality that different teams in the marketing division can use products all together. And then the third axis is we have certain products, like our local listings product, that are not for everyone. So it doesn't make sense to put them on kind of main plan, core plan, but it makes sense to sell them as an add-on. So we design portfolio of add-ons. Mm-hmm. And then we give this information to our R&D teams, and we have a lot of R&D teams, and they independently kind of drive strategy in all of those kind of three directions.
What percent of that $2,000 average year price point are add-on upsells versus the core base pricing, do you know?
Actually, all those three axes, roughly third. So
A third. Oh, wow. Okay. So it's working. It's going well. 2021 comes around. It's in the middle of COVID. You guys say, we hit 67,000 paying customers. Let's IPO. Yeah. You are, if you look at the guy in the purple in the middle, you are two to the left. What was it like ringing that bell in the middle of COVID?
Listen, it was fantastic. Once in the lifetime experience. Highly recommend to everyone who can do that. For me, it was like...
Thank you for the big takeaway, Eugene. Breaking news on the main stage at SAS Open. That's great. You go public. Yeah. The market's loving you, right? The market's loving you. Competitors say amazing things, right? Yeah. Rand is running Moz, and he's going, how the hell do these SEMrush folks grow so quickly? This must have felt nice.
That felt... We always want to have really good relationships with people, especially with Rand. He's actually a customer. So
why didn't SEMrush bid on the Moz acquisition?
Growth was not there, so for us it would have been very dilutive. Mm-hmm. And we went public, right? But we're not a large cap company. Mm-hmm. And depending on the day, we're let's say around small cap, and maybe sometimes we touch mid cap. Mm-hmm. But the problem with small cap is that if you're a small cap, you have to be growth. There are no or I haven't met investors who do small cap value, so you need to grow. And if you buy a company like, in this case, Moz, that doesn't grow...
And give them the numbers really quick. Moz was doing about how much revenue, how much growth?
So Moz was around 100 mil, but when they were selling, now they're smaller. So now
100 million of revenue.
Yeah, now they're probably around 70. Mm-hmm. But if we bought them, we would combine a fast-growing business with business that is sizable but not growing, so your total growth goes down. And like I said, if you're a small cap, you're really priced based on growth rather than anything else. So it just was a deal where you combine two companies and sum of the two is less than both of them separately.
So you're growing revenue, 67,000 paying customers. You go public. It's the middle of COVID. No one else is going public. Your competitors saying nice things, but the press then just like shits all over you. Stocks crashes 20% on day one. What is that like? Do you have the emotional sort of, do you ignore it, or how do you get around that?
Listen, so our CEO, he was extremely upset. I don't recall seeing him so upset. Because for him, it's
from this article or from the stock?
No, from the stock. Yeah, like we didn't have time to read anything, so, we just saw the stock price. You know, investors call you and like, what's going on, and so he was a bit upset, and I understand why. It's kind of like you have a baby and you bring your baby like your daughter to the ball, and nobody wants to dance with your daughter, mm-hmm. so it's not nice, and. For me, I was the happiest man in the world. Because like I did it for me, you know, 20%, whatever, markets go up and down, but we did it. How many people were, you know, on your stock exchange rang the bell? It's a very, very small club of executives, and I was just so privileged to be part of that. And I felt phenomenal. But I think, like I said, if you're a founder and that happens, probably not nice. But also, you know, a couple months later, we were trading way above IPO price. Everyone forgot about mm-hmm. this.
You get through it nicely, and your cohorts continue to expand, right? 116% net dollar retention. You're seeing these bands thicken, which is a sign that, again, that expansion is happening faster. One of the ways, or maybe, can you talk maybe about that 2022 cohort, that green one there? This is sort of how you placed yourself and how you talk about yourself in the market. How were you growing the dollars that each company was paying you so fast in 2020?
So in 2020, you kind of...
Sorry, 2022.
Oh, yeah, 2022. Yeah. You kind of have to sort of what people... Sometimes people say is hide inside your existing user base. So we kept acquiring a lot of new customers, but our focus in 22 was on kind of... Especially towards the end of the year, mm-hmm. To really start focusing on existing relationships, happy customers that we already have, and... offering them additional products in our portfolio that they haven't used before. Because mm-hmm. We felt our portfolio matured enough and we started pushing those kind of attach rates mm-hmm. across our loyal customers, especially those customers who are both loyal and sizable companies, let's say over 50 employees.
Many publicly traded SaaS companies will quote sort of buy down their market, horizontal, vertical integration. Are the logos on this page also your M&A targets?
Oh, no, that's just ecosystem. I think that's kind of like complementary companies. Unfortunately, most of them are much bigger than SEMrush. I would love to buy HubSpot, but I don't think they would consider.
Did you bid on the Optimizely deal?
No, haven't seen. I mean, I knew that was happening, but I was not active.
Did you guys seriously analyze the deal or no?
No, not really.
Okay. So you don't actively think about, hey, what's further down the funnel look? That can drive our M&A strategy.
We do, but we look horizontally. So okay. Kind of the top yep. the top line on this chart, we don't think kind of not vertically, but
down
on this
funnel.
Chart down the funnel. Yeah, yep. We do. Like I said, it's just the problem with those markets that are above and below. In this case below. So web analytics, CRM systems, they're older markets. So leaders in those markets are much bigger, and buying not a leader is challenging. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
No, you nailed it. I mean, look, but the numbers speak for themselves. This is from a 2023 June slide deck. It was the last time that you guys published this kind of data. Why did you stop publishing this kind of data?
I think we'll do it again. It's really, I think we've changed our investor relations person, and they kind of choose what goes on those slides.
I see. Fair enough.
But we'll be sharing way more information soon. We want to do a little bit more on the segmentation side. So I think a lot of people think about our business as SMB business, but we actually sell across the board. We have more than 30% of Fortune 500 companies, and we have at least 5,000 existing accounts who are companies with more than 500 employees. So those segments, this sort of 500 plus employee segment, behaves totally different compared to the rest of the user base. So we want to start kind of showing metrics a little bit differently so people can can see how SMB business behaves and how enterprise business behaves.
And in terms of ARPU expansion, right, when you have 100,000 paying customers, if you can launch a new product line or acquire another company and upsell and add, call it $100 per customer per month, that's $10 million of new MRR, which is obviously, you know, great playbook for any publicly traded SaaS company. You also come in terms of pretty healthy economics in terms of AR per employee, right at the average of most publicly traded SaaS companies, at least on this chart, about $170,000. Mm-hmm. Now, you're feeling the go-forward strategy with this kind of communication, right? So talk a little bit about your product strategy moving forward, maybe touch on AI a bit.
So in terms of messaging, like I said, people don't want to buy tools in general. People want to buy solutions to their problems. So that's why we've changed messaging a little bit. We started, you know, talking less about what we sell and showing more. So there are more visual components on this page if you scroll down, mm-hmm. that actually provide more of a screenshots of functionality so people get the idea. And then, of course, everyone is adding a lot of AI features. We've been adding a lot of AI features probably before other people. We've been using GPT since version 2 in production environment, in our writing assistant products. But for me, it's kind of like a new iteration of technology that is available for people to build things, kind of like cloud computing was back in the day. And for some applications, it makes perfect sense. For some applications, it doesn't make sense. So what we're telling our R&D teams right now, when it comes to AI, look at actual customer problems that can be solved better with AI, and there are tons of them. So for example, we've launched reply to review feature in our local listings product, so small businesses can put their communications on autopilot, and if they have a bad review, someone instantly replies on their behalf and tries to make things right for a customer, and it's all done by AI. We have improved writing assistant product where people can create content that ranks really well in search engines in a matter of minutes. And we also automated a lot of reporting where previously you had to go through 20 pages of different PDF reports or dashboards, and now we just give you, let's say a couple paragraphs of summary so you know the most important things that have happened during the period.
As we wrap up, this is your stock price over the past, call it X many of years. Despite $100 million of more revenue, the stock price is still the exact same, basically, as it was when you guys went public. An employee, you have inside information. You're in leadership. For the employee that has options and they're seeing this, how do you communicate to them, listen, stay patient, focus on long-term, don't get stuck in the day-to-day?
Yeah, I think what we had to do, and maybe a lot of companies had to do, we switched a little bit, not necessarily switched, but we changed the proportion between stock options and RSUs. Mm-hmm. So we told people if you want to get a little bit more now, but less upside, which you could kind of get with options, we can do it.
So you do RSUs.
So we did more. RSUs during this period. So yeah, otherwise you have to just reissue options every time price goes down, goes up. So people, to make sure people not get obsessed with stock chart, and you don't want them to monitor your stock price every day. So
we've talked about new user expansion, new product already. The last thing I want to touch on before we wrap is many in the public and analysts would say you guys spend a fortune relative to other publicly traded founders on marketing and sales. The audience can see the data here on the screen. How would you respond to that?
Well, you got to eat your own dog food, right? If we're a marketing technology company, we have to show people how to sell, spend money on marketing efficiently. That said, when you have macro environment where money is effectively cheap, you can spend a little bit more, and you can have certain efficiency targets. And then when capital is scarce, then you switch and you change your efficiency targets, and as you switch those efficiency targets, you start making a lot of profits. So if you think about our last couple quarters and our guidance for this year, we're going to be very, very profitable. Mm-hmm. Or at least we're guiding to be, So I'm joking. but honestly,
the Robin Hood apps are opening up right now. Congratulations on 2023 for profitable year, which is great.
Yeah, last couple quarters, I think if you look at year over year, we just showed phenomenal year over year improvement in profitability. And that's, again, because we know how to spend money efficiently. So earlier in 2023 and late 22, we reallocated a lot of capital from paid marketing to organic marketing. Mm-hmm. And organic marketing works different. With paid, you kind of spend money and you get results right away. And with organic, You spend money upfront and then you see results a little bit later. It's kind of like renting versus building a house. Paid media is like renting, you pay, you get results, you stop paying, they kick you out, you have nothing. And then with building a house, it takes time to get a foundation right, but once you get it, it's just yours and you keep getting the benefit of having the asset. So that's another reason why we were able to improve profitability and marketing efficiency so fast.
As he wanted to invest back in 2014, the founder said no, they hired him instead. He owned about 2% of the company at its peak before going up and IPOing in the middle of COVID. I mean, crazy bravery. 2021 IPO, Stockton takes a 20% on day one. They stable the ship, net dollar retention growing nicely as they keep building out their product roadmap. Real AI play now, real expansion happening from $2,000 ACVs to $2,500 and above. Now getting more into AI and profitability. Guys, give it up for Eugene from SEMrush. Eugene, thank you. Appreciate it, man. Great job. After you.